Albany Media, 1460 WVOX presents The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel. Provocative conversation about world issues. Now, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Hello and welcome to our program, The Advocates, on WVOX, 1460 AM. My name is Richard J. Garfunkel. I'm the host of this weekly forum. This program is coming from the studios of WVOX in New Rochelle, the Ocean City. The Queen City, pardon me, located on Long Island Sound. It can be also heard live streaming on WVOX.com. One can call in to WVOX at 914-636-0110. But as I say each week, please stay germane to our subject. My guest is Dr. Christopher Bryseth. Our subject is Francis Perkins, our greatest cabinet officer in the fight for economic justice in America. Welcome, Chris, back to The Advocates, and thank you for joining me today.
Good to be with you, Richard.
Thank you. You know, meanwhile, as I say each week, the mission of The Advocates is to bring to the public differing views on current public policy issues and the state of the American case for economic justice, and the role of Francis Perkins must never be forgotten or ignored. Dr. Christopher Bryseth is the new chairman of the board of the Francis Perkins Center of Demer Scotta, Maine, I believe that's it. He is the past president and CEO of the Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt Institute, which is located at the FDR Presidential Library in Hyde Park, New York. He served in that position from 2001 to 2008. He was president of Deep Springs College in California from 1980 to 83 and Wilkes University in Pennsylvania from 1984 to 2001. He earned his BA in history at UCLA, a master's of literature in modern British history from Oxford, and a PhD in European history from Cornell. You know, at Cornell, he lived at the Telluride House where Frances Perkins was a guest for the last 5 years of her life. During that period, she taught at the School of Industrial and Labor Relations. And together, Chris Bryseth and Miss Perkins organized two seminars for House members, one with Henry A. Wallace, the former Vice President of the United States, and the other with James Farley, a very famous political operative and former Postmaster General of the U.S. And following Miss Perkins' death in 1965, Bryseth wrote an article, Francis Perkins I Knew, which provides some of the material on the Francis Perkins' life at the Telluride House, and was the basis for Kirsten Downey's very important and worthwhile book, The Woman Behind the New Deal. When FDR invited Frances Perkins to be his Secretary of Labor, she brought with her a hastily written laundry list of ideas for which she would expect his support if she were to accept his appointment. FDR agreed, and she began 12 years as Secretary of Labor. Throughout these years, some of them during the height of the Great Depression, she worked tirelessly and accomplished a huge number of reforms, establishing new programs for American workers. Among her major and best-known achievements during her long tenure was the establishment of the Social Security system. FDR called it the cornerstone of his administration. Chris, when you and Kirsten Downey, the author of A Biography of Francis Perkins, were my guests almost 2 years ago, I asked you the following question. First of all, who was Francis Perkins and what led her to this pivotal role in American history?
Francis Perkins was a New Englander, a graduate of Mount Holyoke College at the turn of the century, who became very involved in social work and experiences in Chicago with Jane Addams at Hull House, and in Pennsylvania and Philadelphia, where she became very involved in the plight of immigrant girls who became prostitutes. And she then went to New York City, where she, doing a master's in economics at Columbia, became linked with the National Consumers League and got involved with the working conditions of women and children. And in that process, she became very involved with two key political operatives in New York, one Al Smith, who became governor, and Robert Wagner, who went on to be one of the key members of the Senate during the New Deal of Franklin Roosevelt. In 1911, when she was working for the National Consumer League, she witnessed the Triangle Fire and watched girls jumping to their death, many of them on fire, which brings to mind this terrible experience we've just had in Bangladesh in a textile factory. Mm. And she claimed thereafter that, in terms of her part in the shaping of the New Deal. The New Deal began on that day of the Triangle Fire. Mm. Out of that, she became the effective executive of the Factory Investigating Committee, which was chaired by Wagner, who was head of the Senate, and Smith, who was head of the House in the New York Assembly. And out of that, 30 resolutions came that dealt with all aspects of working conditions, fire safety being first and foremost, but it also dealt with conditions affecting women in the workplace and children. Smith made those his kind of centerpiece as he became governor and involved her immediately on a new industrial commission that had been created. And throughout Smith's terms as governor until 1929, she was his key advisor on all matters that dealt with working people and kind of workmen's compensation programs, attempts at old age pension, and so forth. When Roosevelt became governor in 1929, she continued as his industrial commissioner, or in effect the Secretary of Labor for New York, and helped carry on the Smith progressive policies, and they became Roosevelt's policies as the Great Depression hit in New York State as well as everywhere in the country. And she became known as an expert on issues of unemployment, which became, of course, huge in the Depression. And she helped push Roosevelt forward as the leading progressive governor in the country as Hoover wrestled from the presidency with the Great Depression. Mm. From there, Roosevelt made her the first woman to be a cabinet member, and she served all 12 years as his Secretary of Labor. And when I asked her, the first time I met her, what was your most important accomplishment, she said two words: Social Security. Mm.
You know, and just to cut in a little bit on this, Chris, you know, Lawrence O'Donnell, the host of The Last Word on WNBC, MSNBC, that is, on the anniversary of her 133rd birthday, he honored the most important liberal woman forgotten, let's use that word, from American political history. And, of course, as you mentioned, she was the architect and the progenitor of Social Security. And he stated she was our greatest cabinet appointee. How pivotal was Frances Perkins to this new deal? And what was the condition of working America that she found?
Well, the condition of working America was, of course, that there was no national protection for people who were unemployed. There was no old age pension plan. Unemployment was 25% of the workforce in 1933 when Roosevelt became president. So she became the key figure in terms of domestic policy formation, and at a very unusual meeting with Roosevelt when he was president-elect and when he was asking her to be Secretary of Labor, she ticked off the following items that she would want his support on: 40-hour work week, minimum wage, workers' compensation, unemployment compensation, federal law banning child labor, direct federal aid for unemployment relief, Social Security, and health insurance. Mm. And she achieved all of those with him and obviously with the Congress, except health insurance.
Sure. And he had to take that out of the bill basically to get it passed because of the resistance from the American Medical Association,
right,
and other doctors who thought, they've always thought that government involved with medicine would destroy medicine. But you know what? Medicare made them millionaires, most of them.
That's right.
You know, in the world of labor in America in those dark days in the Great Depression, it was dominated by a rough and tumble blue collar old boy network, John L. Lewis, the coal miners, very important union. How difficult was the first woman cabinet officer who was a product of the kind of elitism of Mount Holyoke to be accepted in that difficult role?
Well, it was difficult, but she had encountered that before. She had to learn how to deal with Tammany Hall, and some of the top Tammany officials had become very supportive of her during Al Smith's governorship. She managed to help Smith get things through with the help of Tammany Hall politicians. She'd learned how to deal with men. In fact, she changed her name from Fanny to Frances. Mm. She adopted matronly clothing as she said, it was always better for men if they thought of their mothers when they were dealing with her. Nationally, the labor leaders didn't even want to meet with her, so she took the initiative to go to see them, which they were ultimately very impressed by, and they became, in fact, great supporters of her.
And, of course, Smith was a man of the people. He was not an elitist. He wasn't born to the almost the purple like FDR and other leaders in the country. So maybe her relationship with Smith eased her acceptance with the average working man, because Smith was a man of the streets, to tell you the truth. We have to go to a short financial news flash. You're listening to The Advocates on WVOX 1460 AM and live streaming at WVOX.com. One can also call in to 914-636-0110. I'm with my guest, Dr. Christopher Bryseth. Our subject is the great public servant Francis Perkins and the struggle for economic and social justice in America, which she triumphed. She championed, I think, the New Deal triumph. And we in America are blessed with that legacy. We'll be back in a moment.
With business news at 20 minutes past the hour, every hour, here's the latest update from the Fox Business Network on WVOX Worldwide.
From Fox Business Network, the Wall Street Journal is still a top dog in the newspaper world, thanks in large part to its digital subscriptions. The journal's weekday circulation averaging 2.3 million from October through March, with digital subscriptions accounting for 40% of total circulation. New York startup Wool and Prince claims it has developed a shirt for men that can be worn up to 100 days without being washed or ironed. The shirt is made out of wrinkle-free, scent-absorbing material that was tested by the company's founders in a 100-day challenge that included numerous workouts in the shirts. Wool and Prince has raised over $215,000 on Kickstarter for the project. And Arizona lawmakers have passed a bill that makes gold and silver legal currency. Gold and silver coins would be accepted starting the middle of next year. Backers of the bill say they have serious concerns about the international monetary system. With Fox Business Report, I'm Lauren Simonetti.
Mother's Day is next week, and Pro Flowers is offering an amazing special. 100 stunning blooms for mom, plus a free glass vase for just $19.99. This incredible deal expires this Friday. Go to proflowers.com and use the secret code MOM62. 100 colorful blooms guaranteed to stay fresh for at least a week for only $19.99, plus a free glass vase. The only way to get this amazing deal is to go to proflowers.com, click on the radio microphone in the upper right corner, and enter the secret code MOM62.
From morning.
Great to wake up to in the morning.
To evening.
Working late at the office.
Thanks for making us your number one VOX.
WVOX.
Now, back to The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to The Advocates with my guest, Dr. Christopher Bryseth, and our subject is the great public servant, Francis Perkins, and the struggle for economic and social justice in America. In 1965, as a graduate student at Cornell University, you had the rare privilege of knowing and working with Frances Perkins, one of America's most famous and renowned women, not only here, but all over the world. Chris, what was it like to work with a person who knew everyone and had been a close confidant, advisor, and associate of Franklin Delano Roosevelt?
Well, it was a rare opportunity for me and for the rest of the students at Telluride House. She got to know all of us, each of us. She came to house meetings every Monday night. Once a year, given her Maine background, she gave us a fresh lobster dinner with champagne. Upon graduation, she gave each student a copy of Gratian's Manual, who was a Jesuit philosopher of wisdom, kind of like Machiavelli. And it was her way of making us take ourselves seriously. Yeah. You mentioned before that she and I together put on two seminars, one with Henry Wallace and one with Jim Farley. So we as students in the House, had the opportunity to know two of the key figures in Roosevelt's New Deal, Farley having been his campaign manager, and then in 32, and then as Postmaster General, Wallace being first Secretary of Agriculture, and then Vice President, finally Secretary of Commerce under Roosevelt. And she spent time with us. I often, after dinner, would sit in our living room and ask her question after question about the days in Washington, but also her long life. And she descended from people who had signed the Declaration of Independence. So she had this depth as a New Englander. At the same time, she was so identified with people at the lowest rung of American society, and not only the workers, but the people who were unemployed, so that she had this extraordinary understanding of the American family and the American people. You mentioned her working with Al Smith, who was a person who regarded his only education being at the Fulton Fish Market.
Right.
He was Irish Catholic. She related to those folks as one of them, and I watched this with her, with people in Ithaca, but I also saw her in other cities where we met up, and she had an instant rapport with the most humble people.
Mm. And you know, it's interesting, Chris, you know, you talk about the giants of that era, certainly Wallace, Farley, of course Perkins, but here are three individuals who were household words to all of America. They served in his administration for 32 years, an incredible amount of time. Today, cabinet officers, officials have come and gone. People hardly know who they are, for better or for worse. And you had, you know, you were in the center of this post-New Deal, life with these people who were really paramount to how America adjusted to the new world of the 30s and the post-war era. You know, Social Security has been the cornerstone of American social safety net that has served countless millions since its enactment in 1935. Francis Perkins wanted to include it in the national health care coverage in the Social Security legislation, and we discussed this. What was the resistance I alluded to a bit, and why did FDR have to remove it?
Well, first of all, we'd never had anything like social insurance in America before. And when the committee was set up, and Francis was great at setting up committees of key stakeholders on whatever problem, and she did that back in New York State days as well as during the New Deal, they took on virtually all of the issues: unemployment, workman's comp, old age insurance, disability insurance. But the important thing was the concept of social insurance, and that Franklin Roosevelt was deeply committed to, rather than anything that could be associated with the dole.
Right.
And he saw that the ultimate insurance besides old age insurance would be national health care. But the AMA, the American Medical Association, was so vituperative and saw this as socialism, Bolshevism, that he and Perkins both agreed that they would sink the whole enterprise of social insurance if they kept it included. And it was, and I know this from her telling me, it was the great regret of her career that they were not able to get national health insurance in as it was being developed in other parts of the world.
And Truman pushed it. It was pushed during the Eisenhower administration.
Right.
Johnson pushed it. It failed until recently, of course, and we're well aware times have changed since the 1930s. But today we're in the throes of an economic residue from the Great Recession, which came about from another economic bubble and stock market crash. Today, more personal bankruptcies are caused by health-related conditions than any other circumstance. How important is it today in America that we have this Affordable Care Act that can be extended to the 40 or 50 million who don't have coverage, and the problems of limitations? How critical is this? And we both know the bill could be better.
Well, I think it's critical for at least two reasons. One that you suggest, and that is that we have a large proportion of our national family are unprotected. And what that has led to are enormous costs to the taxpayers from emergency room medicine, which is a very inefficient way for people to have their health care taken care of. The other angle that is important is that because of these costs being so great, because the system is so inefficient, and it includes at the inefficiency is the fee-for-service arrangement where we kind of the insurance system has to pay for every separate thing that happens to you. The costs of health care are terrible, and they are the single greatest part of the long-term debt that is so much at the center of our discussion. And therefore, a health care system, as gem-rigged as this present bill may be, is important to learn to redesign our system so that we control those costs in the out years. And that process, I think, has been started. And just as Social Security went through continuing amendments, even very soon after it was passed, so you're going to see Obamacare amended to take care of problems that weren't anticipated when it was first passed.
No question. And I think that's the heart of it, is that it is a working process to finally get people covered, lower the inflationary cost of health care that is really at the heart of our long-term obligations.
Absolutely.
We have to go to a commercial break. You're listening to The Advocates and WVOX 1460. I'm with my guest, Dr. Christopher Briseth. Our subject is the great public servant Francis Perkins, the struggle for economic social justice in America. And when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about how America was before the New Deal and what was the shape of the rolling stock and labor of America.
With world and national news three times an hour, here's the latest update from Fox News Radio on WVOX Worldwide.
This is a Fox News alert. I'm Chris Foster. Three more people are in federal custody in the Boston Marathon bombing. At least two, we know, college classmates of a younger Maine suspect, Jakar Tsarnaev. The third, confirmed as an American citizen.
Three suspects are in custody. According to a Boston police spokesman, all of their questions are being referred to the FBI. Fox News has also confirmed with a source familiar with the arrests that the three new suspects are suspected of giving some kind of assistance and possible cover to the Tsarnaev brothers, the two main suspects.
Fox News Radio's Courtney Keeley, two classmates from Kazakhstan, already facing immigration and now, a source tells Fox, obstruction of justice charges, accused of taking things like computers from Jokar Tsarnaev's apartment. They were taken into custody 6 days after the bombing, April 21st, accused of violating their student visas by not going to class. This is a Fox News alert.
These difficult economic times present a whole new set of problems for proprietors, owners of independent regional companies. But with all the change comes new opportunities. And we recommend the Rosenberg and Chesnoff Company, founded by Alan Rosenberg as a specialized accounting practice for independent local companies. Rosenberg and Chesnoff knows the pressures and problems of maintaining and growing a retail or service business. With offices in Westchester and Manhattan, Rosenberg and Chesnoff earned their rep advising large firms and high net worth individuals, but they have a special understanding of smaller, growing companies where they are today unequaled in that field. So if you're satisfied with your present accounting firm and advisors, so be it. But if you're looking for more brain power, creativity and dynamism from an independent accounting practice where they don't farm it out to a computer or a junior staffer, we suggest you call Alan Rosenberg's firm, Rosenberg and Chesnoff, for a free consultation. If you've been feeling it's time your accountant was a little more on your wavelength, Rosenberg and Chesnoff, 914-722-6901, or in Manhattan, 212-382-3939.
Of all the gifts we can give our children, perhaps the greatest of all is imagination, a sense of wonder, the joy of discovery. There's a place for this, a one-of-a-kind toy store called G. Willikers in downtown Katona, with the classic toys you loved as a kid, plus the very latest inventive playthings. At G. Willikers, you enter a child's wonderland, a gentle jungle of stuffed animals, exquisite dolls from France and Germany, organic and eco-friendly toys, and sturdy wooden trucks. You'll find a friendly and helpful staff with great suggestions for every child on your list. Locally owned and operated, G. Willikers, 29 Katona Avenue, directly across from the train station in Katona, for the gifts of imagination. 914-301-5274. G. Willikers in Katona, 914-301-5274.
And now with your latest up-to-date forecast, here's Steve Pelletieri's Eye on Weather, exclusively on WVOX Worldwide.
Forecast, Westchester County in the vicinity for this afternoon with some mostly sunny skies. Our high temperatures will climb into the upper 60s. Clear weather this evening, overnight lows falling back into the middle 40s. Sunshine continues on Thursday. Our highs will range into the lower 70s. Mostly sunny, a bit cooler on Friday. East winds gusting to 20. Highs will climb into the middle 60s. Mostly sunny, lower 70s on Saturday. Sunshine, lower 70s for Sunday. I'm Steve Pelletieri, Jr. reporting for WVOX Worldwide and WVIP HD.
When's the best time to listen?
I listen morning, noon, and night constantly.
The correct answer is anytime. WVOX Worldwide.
WVOX.
Now, back to the Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to the Advocates with my guest, Dr. Christopher Bryseth. And our subject is the great public servant, Frances Perkins. Many consider her one of the great cabinet officials in our history, and her role in the struggle for economic and social justice in America. You know, today we hear a constant drumbeat from the Republican Party, their Tea Party faction, and many of their congressional leaders that we need a return to the concept of the rugged individual, the return to normalcy, the American exceptionalism, along with anti-immigrant and anti-union rhetoric. There are daily attacks on government and the age-old attempts to destroy the social safety net are voiced by people we know. We've heard of John Boehner, Paul Ryan, and media provocateurs like Hannity, Beck, Limbaugh, and others. Chris, could you describe what America was like before the New Deal and what the average citizen had to deal with in regards to his world?
You were on your own, and people were taken care of by their families, particularly as they approached old age, and old age could start as early as 50. If you didn't have family and you didn't have resources, there was nothing like unemployment insurance or old age insurance, you went to a poorhouse. And almost every local area, usually supported by the county, had these poorhouses, and that's where people went to die. If your family took care of you, of course, it was a drain on the resources of a family. And while in the 20s there was a great, huge prosperity that built among the middle class, larger and larger numbers of people, the Great Depression knocked that down, and the people who were poor in the Great Depression were people who had achieved middle class status. So their fall was in some ways even more disrupting to them and their private lives. It was the rugged individualism concept was there, although it wasn't defined in those terms. The notion that government should impose itself into the marketplace in protection of people, in protection of all people, was just an alien concept, except among socialists and others back at the time of the of Theodore Roosevelt and the Bull Moose Party and the early progressives under Woodrow Wilson. Those ideas were virtually absent in the politics of the 1920s, except from rather fringe movements. But the Depression changed all that and created the climate in which Roosevelt and people like Frances Perkins and Henry Wallace and Harry Hopkins and Harold Ickes we're in a position to bring in social programs, particularly social insurance programs, that transformed the support system that we now call the safety net. And there's a quotation that those of us at the Francis Perkins Center, which I'm now chairman of the board, from Perkins, and she said, "The people are what matter to government, and a government should aim to give all the people under its jurisdiction the best possible life." Well, that is really counter to what you refer to as the rugged individualism, or what was referred to as the Ayn Rand philosophy of government, which is, frankly, a very important part for Paul Ryan, and for the two Paul brothers, father and son.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting, Chris, that in regards to that, people forget the conditions of labor. They forget the conditions of child labor. They forget the conditions of abject poverty. And what they also forget historically is the 20s were really an aberrational era. That was in the wake of World War One and the prosperity that came out of it. And really, modern America really wasn't set until very possible the crash. In other words, maybe the crash and possibly the Great Recession today is more normal conditions than people would like to admit. And in the 20s, this halcyon era was really aberrational. You know, Frances Perkins was the embodiment of social compassion. Many women of her generation, from Jane Addams to Eleanor Roosevelt, understood the struggle between greed versus need. And again, as you mentioned, today, Ayn Rand is the economic goddess of a new generation of libertarians of the right. What happened with this new breed of Republicans who seem to favor property over people? Should corporations be afforded the same rights as the average citizen?
Well, those are huge questions. In referring to the rugged individualism, I think that's a position that has been held off and on throughout our history, and people define who tend to see that as the dominant expression of what America is all about, think of themselves and their property as the kind of the bedrock on which America is built. At the other side of the equation are the people who are concerned about community, at the local level, but also after the New Deal at the national level. And we've had a constant tension between these two impulses, individualism on the one hand and community on the other. And I think that what you saw coming into the 70s and 80s was a sense by a lot of people, particularly young people, on what the political right, that they were able to take care of themselves, and they increasingly resented the fact that their tax dollars were going to take care of other people whom they saw often in very unattractive terms. And, of course, at the very center of that, all through our history, is the issue of race. Where the focus on community and the nation and the national family was seen as a protection of minorities, that played into a sense of insecurity and resentment by the majority white part of the country. Right now, of course, we're facing a situation where the last couple of years, the majority of babies being born in America are babies of color. So we're headed into a new demographic, and I think that's created a lot of insecurity on the part of a lot of white Americans, and I think it's part of what is reflected in this movement of the Tea Party.
Yeah, it's sort of like the Kulturkampf between the Eurocentrics and everyone else. You know, Republican-controlled state legislators in a number of states, aside from their blatant attacks on women's rights, have been passing anti-union legislation almost all the time. You were a graduate student at Cornell University who worked with Frances Perkins in her final years. Cornell, of course, is the home of the highly regarded School of Labor Relations. Chris, how important was the Wagner Act to the New Deal and America and America's working men and women?
Well, it was crucial, and it was one of the things that Frances Perkins worked on very closely with Robert Wagner, and Wagner's name is on the great act passed, the Wagner Act, and passed, I believe, in 1938, creating the right of labor to organize. Ms. Perkins thought that was absolutely essential to labor having some equality in the marketplace in dealing with what were increasingly large, powerful corporations. And I think the attacks on labor, which started with Reagan and the controllers, and increasingly
controls.
Is taking on the public sector unions, has been a very important part of the right-wing strategy over the last couple decades. And I one of the people I got to know through my work with the Roosevelt Institute was Ted Keel, who was one of the great mediators in great strikes in New York City. And Ted, every time I was in his office, would go over to his desk where he had the Wagner Act open on the page which secured collective bargaining and said that this is at the very heart of our democracy.
That's no question. The challenge to corporate moneyed interests and the balance between corporate money and labor is so critical, and the Wagner Act, of course, gave them the right to collectively bargain. We have to go to the commercial break. You're listening to The Advocates on 1460 AM and live streaming worldwide at WBOX.com. One can always call at 636-0110. I'm with my guest, Dr. Christopher Bryseth. Our subject is the great public servant Frances Perkins' struggle for economic and social justice in America. And we'll be back in a moment or so to discuss about our democracy and how it should function.
And national news three times an hour. Here's the latest update from Fox News Radio on WVOX Worldwide.
This is a Fox News alert. I'm Lillian Wu. A new development in the Boston Marathon bombing.
Three new suspects are in custody. A source familiar with the arrest say they are suspected of giving some kind of assistance and possible cover to the Tsarnaev brothers.
Fox Radio's Courtney Keeley. One suspect arrested is an American. Two are men from Kazakhstan. Fox News learning that the two from Kazakhstan went to Dzhokhar Tsarnaev's apartment and took some computer and other equipment at some point after the bombings, and then they tried to get rid of the equipment. It's unclear, though, whether what they took had any information relevant to the attack. Stocks on Wall Street trading lower after disappointing April jobs numbers from payroll processor ADP, but car companies did well. Ford, GM, Nissan, and Chrysler all reporting double-digit sales increases last month.
It may be the best April in 6 years. The Escape small SUV and the F-Series pickup helped Ford sales last month.
Fox Radio's Jennifer Kuiper, Fox News. We report, you decide.
Imagine a place alive with sights and sounds, where 5,300 gleaming slot machines play their own special music while a live concert is just about to begin. Surrounding you are all new roulette, baccarat, and craps games that put you in the middle of the action. So where are you? Vegas? Atlantic City? Nope, Empire City Casino. Join in on the excitement of all new table games, roulette, baccarat, and craps, and 5,300 slots. Empire City Casino, your home for table games. Exit 2 off the New York State Thruway.
This is America's great community radio station.
Really seems to be in touch with the heartbeat of the city.
AM 1460 WVOX.
WVOX.
Back to The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to The Advocates with my guest, Dr. Christopher Bryseth, now chairman of the board of the Frances Perkins Center in Maine. Our subject is the great public servant Frances Perkins, which her name is on that center, and the struggle for economic justice in America. Looking back on the New Deal and the struggle for economic justice, labor, the rights of labor, the need for social safety nets, the balancing of how capital controlled labor, and the conservative Supreme Court of that day, which thwarted almost every New Deal legislation right up to and until the ruling on the Social Security Act. Another Justice Roberts of that day, Owen Roberts, switched, and Social Security was saved. Other legislation stayed on the books, and eventually FDR changed the court with numerous appointees. Today, the country has been affected by the far-reaching Citizens Union decision. Dr. Bryseth, how dangerous to our democracy is this decision, and what are its long-term consequences about money controlling elections, frankly?
I think the Citizens United decision was a real tipping point on the issue of the place of money in our role of society. I was quite ex- extraordinary for President Obama to criticize the decision right after it was handed down by the court in his State of the Union message with the court sitting in front of him. I think the place of money in our system has been important right from the beginning. So this is not a new situation, but I think the enormous amount of money that is now allowed under this decision, and without it having to be acknowledged in terms of the source, it really is a potential corruption of our system. Americans have had to deal with these kinds of problems before, and it's up to us as citizens. And I think the Occupy Wall Street effort, which spread across the country and to some extent even the world, had the result of focusing on the increasing disparity of wealth between those at the very top who are doing extremely well and everybody else who have been struggling, if not doing really very poorly. And I think that that the reaction to that decision politically is likely to build some protections over time. And I would suspect that while the 99-1 contrast is very important in defeating Governor Romney, particularly after his speech on 47% of takers rather than givers, is likely to be at play in the 2014 election. Mm. And this can be up to people to define what they think is important in terms of protecting our system from too much money. The president, in his humorous remarks the other night at the Correspondents' Dinner, took on Sheldon Adelson directly with $100 million that he spent to try to defeat Obama in the last election, and made it a joke. But the issue is out there, and in our system, we as citizens have to respond to those issues and mobilize ourselves. Yeah.
And it's interesting because we've seen a long-term consolidation of our media outlets into fewer and fewer hands. And frankly, WVOX is one of the few independent stations we have. Many cities and towns today have only one newspaper, and the radio stations that serve those regions are part of giant media conglomerates.
Right.
Others argue that the Internet provides alternative views that cannot be controlled, but In light of this consolidation, there have been rumors that the Koch brothers are interested, and they were behind Citizens United, they're the people, are interested in buying the Los Angeles Times, the Chicago Tribune, Baltimore Sun, Hartford Current. Are we in a dangerous position entering into a New Deal era where a handful of people control most of the dissemination and news, fund all of our elections, silence our universities, and saturate all of our media with messages that promote their interests? Because many people are afraid to speak out today because of this avalanche of money that can go against them in this 24-hour news cycle.
Well, the answer to your many questions is yes. I think those dangers are all there. Because I'm a congenital optimist, what I see is at play, however, is a new awareness of exactly what is implied by your questions. And that is, I think that people are aware that there is an enormous concentration of power right now, and that while there is great individuality in terms of the use of communications media of all sorts with the new technologies, the control of the major instruments of the media in the hands of very few people who have a very strong right-wing political perspective is a real threat. But I would guess that if our system works, that's going to create its own counter movement. And you've seen already the great power of the Internet over the last couple of elections in mobilizing people with good information and new information and highly focused information on what the real issues of campaigns are all about. So I think our system is resilient enough to get around that. I think the effort by the Republicans to not let the NLRB, the National Labor Relations Board, have its full complement of members so that it can't make decisions, the stymieing of making the head of the new Consumer Protection Bureau become appointed. All these are efforts to hold back what I think ultimately will if the American people care about it, will be new securities that the government, through its regulatory functions and its protection of consumers, will be all about. Mm. But if people don't see these as their issues and care about them, then the people who've got a great deal of wealth will control the result.
Well, people get the government they deserve. Yeah. And yes, there's still more people out there. It's the responsibility of the society to educate people to what their needs are, understand the balances. We all understand that we need jobs in this country, that people are a right to make a living, and we all understand that. It's nobody's opposed to that. The question is, how do we want to get into a European situation, pre-World War One, or a European situation where there was oligarchs who controlled practically all the means of production and wealth? You know, FDR's New Deal and essential people like Francis Perkins created a new and emerging middle class that brought prosperity to post-World War II America. It was the strength of unionism. It was the GI Bill. It was many things that helped this country. Today, we see a shrinking middle class, the decline of trade unionism, right-to-work laws, the exporting of jobs overseas, and the theory that self-reliance solves all our societal problems. What are you and the Francis Perkins Center trying to accomplish? What's its mission, and how do you deal with these challenges?
Well, our mission of the Francis Perkins Center, which, by the way, can be seen on our webpage, www.francisperkinscenter.org, is to make the exemplary work and career of Francis Perkins both better known to the American people and relevant to the present struggles to protect this legacy. And we're right now involved in the Social Security debate, focusing on what Social Security has meant to people and means to people even today, and how much that's at stake in the kind of debt and deficit discussions that are centerpiece. We've published a book called A Promise to All Generations on Social Security and Francis Perkins' role. We're convening conferences of experts on social policy. We're also trying to save her homestead in Newcastle, Maine, as a historic site for the American public to encounter this unusual legacy. One thing I'd like to say kind of as we near the end, her great book on Roosevelt, which she wrote right after Roosevelt died, there's no one closer in terms of his colleagues than Francis Perkins. It's been reissued by Penguin. And in the introduction, written by Adam Cohen, the following opening is, if American history textbooks accurately reflected the past, Francis Perkins would be recognized as one of the nation's greatest heroes, as iconic as Benjamin Franklin or Thomas Paine. Like Franklin, Perkins was a brilliant self-creation. There'd never been anyone like her before, nor there has been anyone like her since. Like Paine, Perkins helped to start a revolution. And that revolution is what we call the New Deal. Mm. And it's very much under assault right now.
And that is so true. And I think the criticality that we all face is with education, A. B, young people who are the beneficiary of education, and how critical it is for them to learn what is not only good for them, but how they got where they are today. And I think that's something where institutes like the Francis Perkins Center, the Roosevelt Institute, and other think tank and funded groups play a very strong role. Anything that we're going to come to a close. I want to thank you, of course, for being my guest. You've been here with me before and have been a wonderful, articulate advocate to what you believe. In our closing minute or so, how do you see the build up to 2014? What will be the issues that that are going to confront the American public?
Well, again, the optimist in me, I think the way the politics are sorting themselves out now with gun control and immigration reform, what you're going to see, if particularly on gun control, the Senate can revisit that issue and come out with the 60 votes. Of course, it's absurd that we have to have 60 votes to pass anything in the Senate.
Right, super majorities.
This is the ruling of the minority over the majority. But if you can get those 60 votes, you're going to force the issue to be voted on in the House. And then you're going to have, as you're seeing now with Senator Ayotte in New Hampshire and others in areas that have voted Democratic in the presidential years, you're going to see them under extreme pressure in the House if they voted against this rather modest gun safety legislation. And I think, and you're going to see that on immigration.
Right.
And if the right Tea Party puts too much pressure on Republicans to go along with opposition to both of these measures, that'll be the issue. That'll be a fair, upfront issue for the American public.
I got to go, Chris. I thank you again. Thanks for a great show. If you want to hear this broadcast or any of the archived Advocate broadcasts, you can access on my website, advocates-wvox.com, where information on my guests will be posted. Next week, I'll be back discussing VE Day and the 68th anniversary of this great event, which celebrates the end of World War II in Europe. Again, thank you, Chris Bryseth, for being a great guest, and I look forward to more conversations like
this.
Thank you.
To the Advocates on 1460 WVOX.